ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
When Henry Reynolds left Hobart to lecture in history in Townsville, the textbook he was given to guide students was the widely read collection of essays entitled Australia, A Social and Political History. As Henry notes, it mentioned First Nations people twice, only in passing, and there were no references in the index at all. Well, things have changed considerably since then. As to our historical understanding of the history of Indigenous and other non-Anglo peoples in Australia, a fact that Henry's own work has greatly contributed to. But still, with the vast bulk of the Australian population settled south of the Tropic of Caprahorn, there are still vast gaps in Australia's general knowledge of the North in understanding how northern communities' historical perspectives differ greatly from the conventional southern ones. So Henry Reynolds has decided to write a new history to help remedy that. It's called Looking from the North, Australian History from the Top Down. And Professor Henry Reynolds joins us this evening. Henry, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Oh, I'm pleased to be with you.
It's a strange and enduring issue, the North of Australia, isn't it? We've always, white Australia's always worried about it hugely because we don't seem to have successfully settled there. That almost remains true to this day, doesn't it?
Well, when you consider that north of Capricorn represents 45% of the landmass, and yet even now it has only 5% of the population, it clearly is the idea of the empty north, the undeveloped north, has been there as a problem in people's minds for a long, long time. And the other factor is that it is much closer to Asia than Melbourne and Sydney and Canberra and Perth. Darwin is much closer to Java than it is to the southern capitals. Cairns is much closer to Port Moresby than it is to Brisbane. So those two things, one, its location, its proximity to, if you like, the foreign world, and the fact that it never quite developed in the same way that the South did.
Yeah, you describe the sort of breathtaking audacity of the claiming of the land. Now, I think people are well familiar with what happened in the southern parts of the country. But as you say in your book, it is extraordinary what happened in the rest of the country, particularly Queensland and the Northern Territory and Western Australia. Just describe those moments when white settlers decided the land was theirs, even though they knew most obviously that it was not.
Well, with Queensland, it was claimed by Cook for Britain. I mean, that was a claim that gave Britain the priority over other European powers. And there was no real intention when Cook was sailing up the coast to go there. I mean, it took them 70 years to decide to settle New Zealand. Australia was settled unexpectedly because of the American War of Independence. But it did mean that, Queensland, I mean, the whole point is that in the 1850s, Australian settlement changed dramatically because the British gave the major colonies the right to self-government, and they set up their own parliaments. And basically, Britain just kept a sort of an overlook, and they basically ran their own business. The British had learnt from the American War of Independence, and when they gave them self-government, they meant it. Now, in the case of the three of them, the Queensland, South Australia and Western Australia, it meant that the British gave them control over these vast tropical territories that extended...
Where no one lived, they thought.
No colonists lived
no,
at
no,
all.
At all, no.
Now, that was, in a way, that was more understandable in 1788 when they really didn't know much about it. But by the time that they decided to claim the rest of the Northern Territory and Western Australia, that in 1824 and 1829, they knew that there were people, and often, you know, everywhere they went, there were new groups of Indigenous people.
Describe what happened in Port Essington when the claim was made over the northern part of Australia.
Well, there was the British, in a way, had tried. They'd set up small military settlements in the Northern Territory, and in Port Essington, they claimed... the claim by Cook had come down halfway through the territory. Mm. So the eastern half of the territory was part of New South Wales. The other side wasn't. But the British were concerned that either the French, or even more so the Dutch, could have made a legitimate claim on that country. The Dutch had been there since the 17th century around that coast. So that the British then decided to claim the rest of the Northern Territory, and then a few years later, from the far south, they claimed Western Australia. So by 1829, the whole continent of Australia had been claimed for the British Crown. Now, the other point is that the idea that Australia was a terra nullius, that is, a country where the people didn't really belong to the land, they just wandered over it, and they didn't have any laws or customs, they couldn't have any sovereignty. Now, one can understand why they did that in 1788, but you can't accept that that's what they thought in 1824 and 1829. Mm. And what it meant was that they were basically handing over this huge territory, and possibly 500,000 people, into the hands of the colonists. Mm. So the second half, there were two eras of Australian colonisation. One was with the British, which ended in 1856-59.
With the granting of self-governing rights to the colonies. Yeah.
That's right. The second era of colonisation was the colonisation of the Australian colonists themselves, when they were very small. It was one thing to be governed as part of a huge empire, and by then the British themselves, there was something like 25 million British. But there were just very small numbers.
How many Anglos were in Australia in 1850 in the northern part of Australia?
Well, very, very few indeed.
Measured in the hundreds or thousands?
Oh, yes. There were 8,000 in Queensland. There were 4,000 in Western Australia, and there were none in the territory.
None?
No. Not one.
Even though this had been claimed.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, it is. It's a thing that has continued to bedevil the history of Australia, because the history of Australia often, when it's written, is written about what happened down south with the colonies and the gold rushes and all of that.
Yeah, that's right.
And the history of the north is quite different, isn't it? Even the history of Aboriginal dispossession is followed a similar pattern, but different in itself, particularly in its timescale too.
Oh, absolutely. You see, this is why when I began teaching Australian history to North Queensland they weren't all young people, there were some mature age students, but they were locals, they'd grown up, many of them in smaller places than Townsville, which was for them a big town. Most of them had never been south, hadn't been even as far south as Brisbane. And if you taught the traditional history, there were two things about it. One, the Aborigines scarcely existed, or they had existed, but they were no longer important. The other thing is that local students would be left with the impression that nothing of national importance had ever happened in their part of Australia. So after a couple of years of this, I decided I really had to introduce local history, which I did. I had no idea where this was going to lead, but we did 3 weeks of local history. We did 3 weeks collecting photos, doing family history, and it turned out to be very successful, and we went on doing it. Now, not only did if I'm teaching the North, I've got to know something about it, but really there wasn't all that much written. And then many of my students went on to do higher degrees, honours and masters and even PhDs. And they overwhelmingly chose to do North Australian history. So we created a virtual industry of writing and then publishing Northern history, because publishers would just say, well, this is very good work, but it's about a very regional part and we can't see many people buying it. Mm. So in most cases, we publish the books ourselves. Mm. So then, it was a collective project of filling in the blank spaces.
Yeah. As you say, it feels like a different country, the north of Australia, compared to what happened in the south. For a start, it was widely populated with thriving Aboriginal cultures, as we know. And also, of course, and you've mentioned this, its proximity to Asia was evident in the visits by Macassans and others who traded sea cucumber and other things.
Yep.
And the to and fro had been centuries long. Indeed, Australian Aboriginal people had been to Asia. Some of them had even stayed there.
Yep.
And so this to and fro was contrary to what most people thought, that everyone was sitting here in Australia in isolation, which was never the case. Why do you think, though, that interaction stayed on the coast of Northern Australia, or did it?
Well, that we can't be sure. The Macassans wanted to trade. Mm. They didn't want to settle. Whether the Chinese had reached North Australia is still a matter of some contention. But their great era of exploration didn't last all that long. Mm. When the Europeans arrived in Darwin, they soon discovered that right along the north coast, the Aborigines all spoke Malay. Many of them had been there. They had close relationships, and this was a very, very significant part of the life of those people right across the north, and particularly in Arnhem Land.
Hmm.
And the Yolngu people still commemorate and celebrate their relations with the Macassans.
How was that shut down?
Oh, by the White Australia policy, by the South Australian government and the federal government simply saying they were not to come, without even consulting or telling the northern nations, like the Yolngu. They didn't know. But suddenly, one season in about 1906, the Macassans didn't turn up, and they'd been doing so for centuries.
And they didn't turn up because they felt they'd been harassed, they were harassed?
Well, I'm not sure, but clearly the British government, the Australians, had made it clear to the Dutch government, which after all they were the Dutch East Indies, that they were no longer to come to Australia, and that ended the trade.
The other, when I talk about the North as another country, this was an idea in settlers' minds from the beginning, wasn't it? That it wasn't a suitable place to live. There weren't very many successful white settlements in the north of Australia for a very long time. Some might say that's almost continued to this day, because it was not seen as a place where women and children could thrive, the climate, etc., and so on. It was seen as inhospitable, wasn't it?
It was. And there was a very strong feeling then that white people couldn't really settle, and they certainly couldn't flourish in the tropics.
Mm.
And after all, it is a very large tropical territory, and the climate is very different. Two seasons, the wet and the dry, it's monsoonal, and there was this sense that it was a very difficult task. And those people who did go, many of them didn't want to stay, and that's still the case.
That's still the case, right. That is still the case, yeah. I know, the issue. Well, we'll return to this topic a bit later when we consider whether a use has now been found for the north of Australia, and that's a military use. That is a use which white settlers see as useful. regardless of who was living there. The Frontier Wars, which you have written so extensively about, occurred later here, didn't they? Partly because there were no whites seeking to stake land claims. It starts in Queensland.
Yep.
But it starts in Queensland later than it does, of course, in New South Wales, doesn't it?
Oh, heavens yes. I mean, the first... I mean, Queensland became separated from New South Wales in 1859, and then they had their first parliament in mid of the 1860. Now, at that time, the settlers had only occupied a very small portion of... I mean, the Darling Downs and the country not just north of Brisbane, but there wasn't much else. They didn't even know that... I mean, they knew the coastline, but they didn't know much else. But this was the... I mean, they were in two minds. On the one hand, they felt... This allows us to get close to Asia. We'll, we can engage in Asian trade. We could have relationships. We might even become like a Singapore and have relationships with all the... I mean, the great trade routes that still crossed above Australia, obviously, but between, you know, from a long time back, from the Middle East down through the Straits of Malacca and then up to East Asia. I mean, they were then and still are very important trade routes. And the early Queensland colonists thought they could tap into this. And they actually set up a settlement on Cape York called Somerset, of all names. And then Thursday Island. And they hoped indeed that this would bring significant wealth to Queensland. But that proximity was both an attraction and a threat. And it continued. I mean, that conflict of view about the proximity of the Pacific and Asia is still there. You know, we indeed now talk about closer relations with Southeast Asia, and I mean at this very moment we're talking about our relationship with ASEAN. But on the other hand, there's also the threat that many Australians feel about the proximity of Asia, and it's been there for a very long, long, long time. But as I say, the big difference between settling of the South and settling of the North was that in the North there was too much territory and not enough people, not enough colonists.
Yeah, because part of the problem was, of course, that New South Wales gets squatted on by huge numbers of people who simply take the land and then, you know, almost dare the government to take it off them, which they don't in the end. And so squatting... This is the model, in a sense, that gets established, and that is the model that starts to get practiced in Queensland. But part of the problem is, as you say, that the New South Wales had a convict population, therefore they had this great supply of pretty much free labour.
Yep.
Now, Queensland didn't have this because, you know, transportation ceases in the mid-century, so they don't have it, and there's nobody to work the runs, as it were. And this causes problems for white settlers, doesn't it? White squatters.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the fundamental differences between the South and the North. In New South Wales and Van Diemen's Land, i.e. Tasmania, each had something like 75,000 young men and women, a small percentage of women, but 150,000 young Britons were sent to Australia and became the labour force. They were cheap labour. They also could be told to go into remote and dangerous places, and they had to stay there. It was either that or the chain gang. So that when you got to the North, there were nowhere near... I mean, had the British continued and decided to go on using transportation, because they had gone over to using jails, penitentiaries, had they sent 75 to 100,000 people into North Queensland, it would have dramatically changed the nature of the colonisation, because many, many of those people would actually have stayed. They would have got used to it. And But, you know, there were never enough Europeans to do the settlement in the way it had been done in the South.
Hmm. Yeah, you talk about. I want to talk about the role of the native police in a moment, but you talk about what happened with the frontier wars, and there were some moments of accommodation. It seemed that, particularly around Bowen, and you talk about in your book, to describe what happened here.
Well, the Queensland government, the very new government, decided it had to develop the north. It had to develop their great colony. I mean, it stretched from Brisbane 2,000 kilometres north and 1,000 kilometres west. It was a very, very large territory. And they decided that what had to be done was they had to throw open the land for settlement. And so they established the first large area around the Burdekin River and its tributaries, which would be thrown open to squatters who could move in. They could find, a place with, you know, obviously water, and then make a claim on it, and they would be given a lease for a short time, and they had to stock it. And if they stocked it, they then got a 14-year lease and could settle down with the expectation that they would continue. And that is indeed what happened. I mean, many, many people, there's still this sense that land ownership is the overwhelmingly important way to achieve prosperity and to grow and to have status, to develop your own large estate which you could hand on to your children. So that the desire for land is still overwhelmingly important in a colonial society. Mm. So there's a great rush to go north, both by land and sea, to the new, very new settlement of Bowen on Port Denison. And the squatters arrived, and they headed off into the interior looking for a place to claim. And in Queensland, because they need to do it quickly, it was the only real source of income for the government, they had very, very large areas they could claim, which they did. And so there was this land rush, and in a comparatively short time, all the accessible land, the land that had prospects, had been taken up by squatters. And they had to go south and get sheep or cattle and stock the land. Now, their problem was that, particularly with sheep, in those, remember, these are totally unfenced runs. Mm. They have to have shepherds. Even so, it's a fairly small workforce, but they need to bring in labour. And because they're very large territories and the sheep, you know, just can't be looked after all the time, the first conflict really took place about the animals. I mean, the animals were far more disruptive initially than the white men, because they went everywhere and they very quickly, occupied the land. They were the creatures who occupied the land. But the local Aboriginal, the local Indigenous nations, and remember, they are small, self-governing nations. Mm. Realise that the way to really challenge the white men was to kill their animals or drive them off, which they did, often in large numbers. Mm. And it was very hard to stop them. And they hid away in the hill country, of which there was quite a bit, or they hid away on offshore islands or in the mangrove swamps, and then came out and attacked the sheep and cattle. And this was an economic threat, because most of these people, although they wanted to be big landowners, were often in debt before they had started. They'd borrowed money, particularly from Goldrush Melbourne. They'd borrowed capital to claim the land, but above all to stock the land. And so if there was a real attacks on their sheep and cattle, they may well have not been able to continue, and many of them were driven out simply by the economics of it.
Mm. Yeah, exactly. Conflict begins, of course, and it's put down very brutally, isn't it? There are a couple of celebrated massacres of white settlers,
yeah,
which inflame public opinion.
Oh, very much
who revert to a view that you know, Aboriginal people are just savage natives and therefore need to feel the end of a bullet. And this view is pretty widespread, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, the expansion into the north followed on from two significant large killings of Europeans, particularly 19 members of the Wills family and their servants in 1861 in central Queensland. And this was by far the largest loss of European life anywhere in Australia in one attack. So anyone moving north knew about this. I mean, everyone would have known exactly what happened. They move north with this experience. After all, there'd been a generation of conflict as the settlers moved north from Sydney and the Hunter Valley. So anyone moving into Queensland knew there was a history of conflict. They also knew that the only safe possibility was to keep them out. That is, if you saw them, you shot at them. Because the Wills family had not done that. The Wills family had tried to make friends with the local people. But because other people didn't, it was the Wills who suffered the consequences. And so this idea that you've got to keep them out was, not surprisingly, was felt by almost everyone, at least initially, until it became obvious that you could solve two problems together. That is, you could let them in, and that's the term they used. You could let them in onto your sheep or cattle run. You could let them in to Bowen, to camps outside the town. And you could let them in, which brought the fighting to an end, but also provided the labour. And so the young Aboriginal men and women became indispensable to the pastoral industry. They very quickly, I mean, they knew, above all, they knew the country. You know, if you had a huge run, and after all, you didn't know much about it, the local people were so expert. They knew exactly where the country was. They knew where the sheep were probably wandered to. They knew where and when water was available. And very quickly, the young men and women became expert at the business. You know, their horsemanship became, within a matter of years, became quite celebrated. And so that pattern of the pastoral industry in the north depending not on convict labour but on Aboriginal labour, that becomes the pattern right up to the 1960s. And in the more remote places, Aboriginal labour was almost the only labour available.
There was, yeah. Professor Henry Reynolds is with us. We're talking about his book, Looking from the North. It's a history of Australia, concentrating on the northern part of Australia, which is for most Australians another country, and indeed always remains so. Certainly was the time we're talking about, in the middle of the 19th century. Tell me about the role. This is a dark period, isn't it? The role of the native police in the frontier wars, Henry.
Well, Queensland...
Because this was peculiar to Queensland, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, Queensland faced the problem of trying very quickly to settle an enormous area with a small number of Europeans. And the problem was that how do you stop the Aborigines, even if they just have economic war and they kill the sheep and cattle, the whole pastoral industry could be, you know, driven into insolvency, so that they needed a force that could use enough violence to allow the pastoral industry to succeed? And the answer was, and they inherited the native police from Queensland, from New South Wales, that had established a small force before Queensland was separated, where New South Wales itself was suffering serious resistance in the northern rivers. So Queensland adopts this and greatly expands it and goes on using it for the rest of the century. That is a paramilitary force of Aboriginal troopers with white officers, and they became absolutely central to the settlement of the north. And they continued to operate until the early 20th century, right across the whole of the colony.
Yes. Despite... Well, not despite the frontier wars, but the colonisation of the north. I don't know what. How would you describe it? Because it's not been spectacularly successful in terms of. It certainly decimated a lot of Aboriginal culture, but Aboriginal culture remains alive and well, and numerous in terms of its population, ways that it's not in other parts of Australia.
Oh, absolutely.
This is an interesting thing about Northern Australia, is that it's not like the rest of Australia in that Aboriginal people in Northern Australia have agency, land, language and culture in volumes in the way that they do not, for example, certainly in Tasmania and certainly in New South Wales or South Australia or Western Australia for that matter.
Exactly. I mean, the point was that the Aborigines weren't driven off their land.
No.
They stayed there, and they became the indispensable workforce because they didn't want to leave. And it's easy to say, they were just slaves, but they were there because they wanted to be there, because it meant that they continued to live on their land. Most pastoralists didn't care if they continued to have their traditions, and the whole pattern of work on the pastoral stations was fascinating. That is, all the work had to be done in the dry season.
Hmm.
Once the wet season started, late in the year, from, you know, December right through till Easter quite often, there wasn't much work. And so the boss didn't want to have to keep feeding the Aboriginal camp. So the boss said, all right, Jackie, you can go off now. And they were only too happy to go off. They were often helped by the white boss, who gave them bags of flour and whatever else they wanted, and even gave them a wagon to go off into the country. And they went back into their back into their homeland, back into their country, where they often met their own people who worked on other stations, or some people who still hadn't come in. So they spent 3 or 4 months a year back practicing traditional life. They changed the pattern, the sort of time of their particular ceremonies, and they negotiated, solved problems and negotiated marriages, all of this out in the bush. And then when the dry season began, back to the station. So they stayed on their land right across the north. So when, as I call it, the land rights revolution came, they were there. And they now, just in the last week, practically the whole of Cape York has returned to the local people. And this is true in the Territory, and it's true right across to the Kimberley. In the Kimberley now, 97% of the land is held in one form or another by the local people. It is an astonishing... it's a counter-revolution. The revolution was when the land was occupied by the white fellows, but the Aboriginal people never thought it wasn't their land.
Mm. No. Whites continued to think, and, you know, there's still so much hand-wringing, isn't it, about the north of Australia, because, you know, from the south comes this constant complaint about why aren't we doing more about it? Why aren't we settling it? And we have projects like the Argyle Dam, and we think we should be growing cotton and all sorts of other crops up there. We think, why isn't there a big deep water port up, for example? But the thing that defines Northern Australia is its remoteness, isn't it? Australia is a massive place.
It is.
It's remote from all the big population centres, and attempts by white settlers to establish any large population centre in the north have singularly failed, haven't they?
Well, except for the Queensland coast. I mean, you know, the well-watered Queensland coast, and particularly from, say, Mackay north to Cairns and Port Douglas. Now, that's where the only place where there's a concentration of population, and where people have been there for generations. And that's, to some extent, it's the discovery, you know, of gold fields, but above all, the success of the sugar industry on the tropical coast. Mm. And this is, once again, it's dependent on cheap labour. One, there wasn't much white labour. And two, if you had to employ white labour, they couldn't have possibly competed with sugar from on the one side Fiji and on the other side Mauritius. So if they wanted to have a successful sugar industry, they had to employ cheap coloured labour, which they did on a large scale. Almost as many Pacific Islanders founded the sugar industry as convicts founded the pastoral industry in the south.
Mm. Tell me about the history of Darwin. Why? What was it, and how do you think it's been regarded now as a place of white settlement?
Or, yes.
And for that matter, does it have any significance for Aboriginal people?
Well, it does. I mean, the local people are still there, and you know, the first Land Rights Act, which was the one introduced by Whitlam and then brought to fruition by Fraser, the Northern Territory Land Rights Act, gave freehold land to large areas and then set up the land councils. And so a large amount of the north, indeed, is held and controlled by the land councils. Now, Darwin itself, once again, it got its real impetus from gold that was discovered to the south of Darwin, and Darwin was the port of entry. It, from the very start, had large numbers of Chinese, because the Chinese came in to make the railway down to Pine Creek.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chinese stayed, and right up until the Second World War, Darwin was as much a Chinese town as it was a European town. And many of the Europeans just went there for work and then, you know, left as soon as they could.
Still happens today.
It still happens today. The churn of population in the Northern Territory is still very, very striking.
Mm.
And so that Darwin only had about 5,000 Europeans at the time of Federation, and it had much the same in the 1930s. So that the plans for the development of the North are indeed talking about building up Darwin, Cairns and Townsville into cities of a million people. Now, Cairns and Townsville are now quite big cities, and that probably will work, partly because, as I say, that is like an extension of southern colonisation, where it worked and people have lived there, and many people have families, and although there's, as we discovered, people came and come up there and go, but it is much more stable demographically than anywhere else in the north.
Yeah, Professor Henry Reynolds is with us. We're talking about his book, Looking from the North, A History of Australia, from a perspective of the northern part of Australia, profoundly another country, and in practice and in imagination for Australia as well. White people have always looked to it and thought, we've tried things and failed again and again and again. We were reminded during the Second World War that it was, because of its proximity to Asia, hang on, we are vulnerable across the north as well. So we've always thought of it in those terms too, haven't we, as a place of military threat. If there was an invasion, this is where it'll come from.
Yes.
This thinking seems to have crystallised in recent times too, if you're talking about the modern day, as perhaps the north of Australia and perhaps its role as far as the southern part of Australia thinks is as a military defence, as a first line of defence. That's where missiles and military bases should be, do you think?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. That's the current thinking. But in a strange way, it's a reversal of that idea in the Second World War that Australia should only defend itself south of the Brisbane line.
Hmm.
Now, in a way, that made sense. I mean, the point about the North is that even now, why, if you wanted to attack Australia, the last place you would want to land your forces is anywhere in the North.
No, that's right.
You'd land in Cape
York.
You'd
have the same problems as everyone else has had if you did that.
You'd land on Cape York and march south, or you'd land in Darwin and march south toward to Adelaide. I mean, it doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, that makes us safer. That is, when we're an island, you've got to get all your equipment and all your troops and everything else off ships, and you've got to be able to land them successfully in large numbers. Now, that presents an enormous challenge to any person who wanted to invade Australia, be it China or America. You know, the great powers would still find that an enormous ask. So that the idea that invasion from the North simply made no sense at all. If you wanted to create real problem for Australia, one thing you could do is to invade the West. You could invade the West, you could take it over with comparatively small force, and then how could they get you out of there? You know, run their tanks across the Nullarbor, attack the place itself? No, because then you're killing your own people. So the idea of Australia being threatened from the North doesn't make much sense. But that's why what interests me about the current thinking. The current thinking is how we can use power out of Australia rather than defending ourselves from people coming in. That's the thinking. And that's what strikes me as very strange. They are not building up the North to defend the Australian heartland, which is the South, south of Brisbane. You know, that's the Australian heartland, economically and demographically and every other way. But to defend it by building up great army bases in across the North doesn't make much sense if that's what you're wanting to do. No, the whole idea is that this is to be able to exert our power into Asia, and behind everything else is the idea that if war comes with China, above all, the Americans want to use Australia in the way that MacArthur used Australia in the Second World War.
As a base.
As a base.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty clear about the Japanese too, isn't it? That they weren't so much thinking of occupying Australia as they were of neutralising the North as a base for the Americans.
Yes, well, if I mean, it's not, people haven't really thought this way, but if we decided to be neutral, now, the Irish did in the middle of Europe, the Swedes did, the Swiss did, the Portuguese and Spaniards did, but above all, Ireland remained neutral. Now, if Australia had said in 1941, now remember, we declared war on Japan rather than the other way around. We could have said, no, we are neutral. We will not be part of this war. Apparently, the emperor believed in neutrality. That's why Macau was never touched. And why the Japanese wanted to attack us was because of America. That's what made us vulnerable. That's what made us, you know, a necessary target. But, you know, despite anything the Japanese could do, it was an invulnerable base for the Americans as they prepared for their invasion back into Asia.
Yes, exactly. Just as a final note, Henry, there seems to be an optimistic note in your book too about the notion of, you know, the long period of colonisation and decimation of Aboriginal culture and so on across the North. You see that there are, this is in a sense that perhaps the the tide has turned, that the land rights, the victories of Mabo and so on have now seen a very significant part of Australia back in Aboriginal hands with Aboriginal culture and language preeminent.
Yeah.
And that this may be the place from which there's to be a new flowering. Is that the way you would see it?
Oh, yes, I think so. I mean, there were two things. One, indeed, there was the land rights brought about firstly by the politicians and then above all by the courts, in particular those two judgments, Mabo and Wick. And Wick was so important because it determined that all the pastoral land right across the north was held under pastoral leases. And the assumption was that this gave the holder of the lease, in effect, ownership, and that a pastoral lease would extinguish native title. But in actual fact, Wick said no. On pastoral leases, the Aboriginal people still have rights. You know, it's not ownership any more than the pastoralist has got ownership. They've both got rights to the same land, different sorts of rights. So that right across the north, this has had a dramatic effect. But the other thing that happened at much the same time was the homelands movement, where, you see, right across the north, the White Australia policy was applied internally. And the way it was applied internally was to put Aborigines onto missions and reserves where they were basically not allowed to leave and where they would become assimilated. That was the long-term idea. Now, certainly from the 1970s onwards, people began, family by family, it was a slow bit by bit movement, they left the scenes of assimilation and they walked back to their country and sat down on it and occupied it. Now there are now something like 1,000 or so homelands right across the north. If you look at the map where they are, it's quite extraordinary. They have reoccupied the country. Now, this raises that fundamental question of sovereignty. You know, whose land is it and whose law is applied? Now, this is what the Uluru Statement, the central point about the Uluru Statement was they said, we still have sovereignty, and it exists side by side with the sovereignty of the Crown. Now, that, in a way, was forgotten when all we talked about was the voice to Parliament.
Yeah.
But in actual practice, most of those people have gone back in order to maintain their culture, speak their language, and use their customary law. And that's happening right across the north.
It is. It's look, it's a terrific book, and it ought to be read by everybody. Looking from the north.
I hope so.
Looking from the north, Australian history from the top down. Henry Reynolds, one of the country's preeminent historians of frontier conflict and Indigenous Australia, has been with us, looking back from the towards the end of his life over the history of the north of Australia. Henry, terrific to talk with you and spend time with you as well. All the best, and thank you.
Oh, well, a great pleasure.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife. Yeah.